Hello there. Today is Tuesday, February 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, an impending impeachment vote will come just 24 hours after the president gives a State of the Union.
Will have lasting implications for the future of the presidency, not only for this president, but for all future presidents, whether or not the office of the presidency of the United States of America is above the law.
Democrats competing to take on President Trump in the general election get their first test. Also ahead, Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Democrats across Iowa Monday night look to balance their desire for fundamental change with their craving to defeat Trump as they open the first contest of the 2020 presidential primary season. Hundreds of thousands of Democrats gathered at community centers, high school gyms, and more than 1,600 other caucus locations in the premiere of more than 50 contests that will unfold over the next 5 months. Now, these caucuses are the first verdict, they will be, on what the party stands for in the age of Trump and who it feels is best positioned to take on the Republican president who Democratic voters are desperate to beat this fall. Joining us now live in studio, VOA national correspondent Jim Malone with the latest. Jim, what is the latest, and do we have any kind of idea of who is winning this thing?
Well, the latest is that the information we need to tell you the latest is late. So we are waiting for the very first results to come from around the state of Iowa. You know, this is a complicated process, we should remind everyone. This is not like a ballot box vote, like a primary campaign. What happens here is people actually go out in the evening to local community centers. And sometimes they're able to lobby neighbors. They line up behind the names of the candidates they want. And it's all sorted out throughout the evening. But for some reason this year, the results are much more delayed than they have been in previous contests. So we don't have a lot of firm results right now. And of course, Iowa has a very important role in our election process. It kicks off the whole primary campaign for both parties, really. And I guess the only results I can really tell you about with any certainty is that President Trump easily won the Republican caucuses in Iowa tonight. I think he was at 96% or 97% of the vote.
But that would be running against no competitor, correct?
There are two competitors, but the president's expected to have an easy time. But it points out an issue for the Democrats. The Republicans are united behind President Trump, even with the impeachment saga playing out here. And so the Democrats, one of the issues that they'll be looking to keep in mind as they choose a candidate is how they bring the party together after what could be a long and divisive primary battle. We saw 4 years ago it was not the easiest thing in the world to have Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton come together. Sanders eventually did campaign for Clinton, but there were some hard feelings, and we'll have to see once we start getting results and once we see the other states to come down the line where the Democratic Party heads.
It does seem a little unbalanced according to the demographics of the country, which is Iowa happens to be a very, shall we say, white state, doesn't necessarily represent the whole of America. So is it fair to make an assumption that whoever wins is really representing what the rest of the country wants and will vote for?
Well, we should remind everyone, the reason Iowa gets to be first is just by tradition. It started in 1972, and Iowa with the first caucuses and New Hampshire with the first primary, that'll be next week, they have sort of a commitment to each other to remain first among all the states in terms of letting voters make their choices known first in the nation. But you're right. I mean, Iowa is well over 90% white, and it does not reflect the diversity that we see in the Democratic Party. And that will be borne out in later contests, particularly when you get to states like South Carolina and other states with large African-American populations.
And is there any indication, while we don't know any results, of what kind of turnout there are for these caucuses tonight or Monday?
Well, just sort of surveying the scene from there, there are a lot of anecdotal evidence that huge numbers showed up. I think the record is over 200,000 from 2008 when Barack Obama first ran. They're predicting it's going to be more than 200,000 again this evening. And we did hear of several locations where people showed up where they were not able to accommodate everyone, and they had to make some, you know, last-minute arrangements to make sure everyone was accommodated at the site. So it looks like a strong turnout. Look, the Democrats, there are two things on their minds. They want to find someone to beat Donald Trump, but they also, many of them are looking for someone to bring sweeping change to the United States in terms of policies. So how Democrats balance those two ideals and those two principles is going to be a key thing moving forward.
All right. Well, we always appreciate your perspective, and I guess it's going to be a long night ahead for you waiting for the results to come in.
Seems like it.
VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone joining us live in studio. Thanks so much. Well, House lawmakers prosecuting the impeachment case against President Trump and the president's defense team spent 2 hours Monday making their closing arguments. The final outcome of the case seems secure, with Republicans holding a 53-47 majority in the Senate and none indicating that they plan to vote to remove Trump from office. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson files this report.
A closing plea from the former prosecutor who has spent months leading the case against President Trump.
No, you and we represent the American people, the ones at home and at work who are hoping that their country will remain what it has always believed it to be, a beacon of hope, of democracy, and of inspiration to those striving around the world to create their own more perfect unions, for those who are standing up to lawlessness and to tyranny.
The House impeachment managers warning the Republican majority Senate expected to vote against removing Trump from office.
You will send a terrible message to the nation that one can get away with abuse of power, obstruction, cheating, and spreading false narratives if you simply know the right people. Well, today, senators, I reject that because we are a nation of laws.
Today, the Senate will hear.
But Republicans see Democrats' impeachment efforts as the harm to America's democratic system.
What the House Democrats have done to this nation, to the Constitution, to the office of the president, to the president himself, and to this body is outrageous. They have cheapened the awesome power of impeachment. And unfortunately, of course, the country is not better for that.
The president's counsel arguing the reasons to vote against Trump's removal from office are clear.
There are a number of reasons why the articles of impeachment are deficient and must fail. The president did not condition security assistance or a meeting on anything during the July 25 call. The president sets the foreign policy. The unelected staff implements the foreign policy.
As the impeachment trial closes, the 2020 presidential election nominating contest just getting underway Monday with the Iowa caucuses. Republicans said that process, in the hands of voters, should decide Trump's fate.
2020 presidential election is underway. Yet, we all are asked to remove the incumbent from the ballot based on an impeachment supported by only one party of the Congress.
Democrats have argued impeachment is an urgent effort to prevent Trump from inviting foreign election interference.
And these arguments demonstrate a deeply misguided, or I think intentional, effort to mislead about the role that impeachment plays in our democracy. If you believe, as we do, and as we have proven, that the president's efforts to use his official powers to cheat in the 2020 election jeopardize our national security and are antithetical to our democratic tradition, then you must come to no other conclusion that the president threatens the fairness of the next election.
Senators now have the opportunity to take to the Senate floor to explain their vote, a decision that is coming down to the last minute for some.
I am truly struggling with this decision and will come to a conclusion reluctantly, as voting whether or not to remove a sitting president is the most consequential decision that I or any U.S. senator will ever face.
Senators will continue their speeches Tuesday and hold the final impeachment vote Wednesday. just hours after Trump visits Capitol Hill for his annual State of the Union speech. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Well, the Senate will hold a final vote on whether to acquit or convict and remove President Trump from office tomorrow. That is one day after he is scheduled to deliver his annual State of the Union speech. Two American presidents have delivered State of the Union addresses under the threat of impeachment, Democrat Bill Clinton and Republican Richard Nixon. White House correspondent Patsy Wuttakuswara looks at how the two presidents handled their speeches.
The President of the United States!
Trump may become the third president in American history to deliver his State of the Union speech under the threat of removal from office, following Bill Clinton in 1999.
Let us lift our eyes as one nation, and from the mountaintop of this American century, look ahead to the next one, asking God's blessing on our endeavors and on our beloved country.
And Richard Nixon in 1974. Facing impeachment from the Watergate scandal, Nixon used part of his speech to defend himself.
I believe the time has come to bring that investigation and the other investigations of this matter to an end. 1 year of Watergate is enough.
Well, Clinton took a different approach.
It was a very optimistic, upbeat speech about how good conditions in the United States were, how powerful the American economy was, and how many jobs had been created and what economic recovery had been done, but completely ignored the impeachment issue.
The February 5th speech is particularly important to Trump ahead of the November election.
The economy is roaring along. Unemployment has been extremely low. In fact, the unemployment rate for African Americans and Hispanics has hit record lows. I mean, those are the kind of achievements that I think a president would want to talk about no matter what else is going on in Congress, including impeachment.
Clinton was acquitted while Nixon resigned before he was impeached. Analysts expect Trump's approach to be a mix of his predecessors.
He will probably extol the achievements of his administration, particularly on the economy, but he will also probably mention impeachment and probably attack quite strongly the Democrats for their policy on that.
If his rallies are any indication, whatever happens in his impeachment trial, Trump will likely continue to project optimism.
This November, we are going to win back the House, we are going to hold the Senate, and we are going to keep the White House.
Patsy Wuttakuswara, VOA News.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Iran will stop coordinating with Ukraine after air traffic control recordings leaked during that deadly crash. An HIV vaccine trial fails in South Africa. Google is working with world health officials to combat coronavirus lies online. And Kenya farmers have been hit by the worst locust swarms in 70 years. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Health authorities are planning for a possible pandemic as they work to contain a respiratory illness in China that's caused by a new virus, the coronavirus. Governments are limiting travel, isolating sick people, and keeping travelers returning from the affected region under quarantine to watch for symptoms. The death toll in mainland China from the new type of virus has risen to 425, with the total number of cases now standing at over 20,000. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says U.S. planes will fly Americans home from China.
We have a handful more flights that will be heading to China to bring Americans back home from Hubei province. The exact timing of those, we're still coordinating with the Chinese government. We anticipate that they will happen in the next handful of days, and we'll return those American citizens. We may well end up bringing some citizens back from other countries as well.
Pompeo says the U.S. is trying to help Chinese officials deal with the virus outbreak.
We hope also to bring some medical supplies in the context of those aircraft traveling into the region. We're working closely and hand in hand with the Chinese government to try and resolve what is now this global epidemiological challenge.
Other countries are continuing evacuations and restricting the entry of Chinese or people who have been recently traveling in the country. In the province at the epicenter of the outbreak, a specialized 1,000-bed hospital has started treating patients, and a second hospital with 1,500 beds is set to open within days. The World Health Organization says the number of cases will keep growing because tests are pending on thousands of suspected cases. Joining us now to discuss what's happening is Dr. Sanjaya Senanayake, an infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine at the Australian National University. Thanks for being with us. So what's your view of what we're seeing and how serious do you think this is?
I think we're still in the early stages of the outbreak. So we're only into sort of week 8, so we're still learning about the virus's behavior. We're seeing a lot of cases being confirmed every day in the last few days, particularly coming from China. So yesterday there were almost 2,600 new notifications. But it could well be that this could be a peak and that it may be on the way to falling, because in a few days it'll be 2 weeks since China instituted the lockdown in Wuhan. And if that has been effective, that isolation measure, then we might see a reduction of cases. And even though we have seen cases in, I think, 23 countries now, there's been very limited spread beyond those cases in most countries. So at this stage, most other countries outside China seem to have this under control. The other thing I would say is that what we have seen so far, even though it seems to be quite infectious, most people who get it are getting a very mild illness. There are around 2% of people who are dying, unfortunately, but they're tending to be older people with underlying health problems.
So while there is growing concern, you're saying, and while it is highly infectious, it doesn't appear to be extremely deadly. It almost seems like it's like maybe the flu or something like that, to where, you know, some people do die from it, but it's not a given that you'll die from it.
Exactly. Look, having said that, I guess flu is about 20, if this 2% mortality rate is right, flu is about 20 times less deadly than this, but accounts for about 600,000 deaths a year just because it's so infectious. So a lot will depend on how infectious this is. It's certainly not looking like it's going to be the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, which killed about 40 to 50 million people in a year, and those were predominantly young, healthy people. It's not looking like that. But I think it is definitely worth taking the precautions that nations are taking, because it is a new infection. We don't have immunity to it. Last week, we also discovered that people who aren't sick with it but are infected with it can still infect other people. And there's even some evidence that some of the testing can be sporadically incorrect. So some people will test positive one day and they'll test negative the next day. So for those reasons, I think we should be concerned and cautious and vigilant, but we shouldn't panic.
If this is so new and we're still learning about it and how it behaves, how would we treat something like this?
So I guess the three big interventions to stop an outbreak like this, so the one we're doing at the moment, which is public health measures, early identification of people at risk or who are susceptible and isolation of them, then vaccines. And in the US, the NIH, I believe, has started research on a vaccine, as has the Queensland University here in Australia. But realistically, I think at best we're looking at 6 months before we can start testing that for safety and effectiveness. Now, you mentioned treatments. Well, there are at least a couple of drugs which have seemed to have some impact on another coronavirus called MERS. One of these drugs is an HIV medication, and the other is a medication that was developed for Ebola. I had Ebola medication, remdesivir, in one of the patients with this coronavirus, and they seem to improve. But of course, that's just one patient, and you don't know if that was pure luck and they were going to get better anyway or not. So there is hope.
Civic groups, political parties, and the government are pleading for the women of Cameroon to vote in next week's local and parliamentary elections, despite threats by separatist groups who have vowed to disrupt the polls. Female candidates and women who campaigned on behalf of others fear their efforts may amount to nothing if women do not come out to vote. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Unity, justice.
Unity,
justice.
Unity,
justice for all.
Representatives of NGOs and government ministries are joining political parties at rallies in Cameroon's capital in what they call a special campaign for women to perform their civic duties next Sunday. Female candidate Alvin Yinda says she is impressed with the initiative because the absence of women from polling stations on the day of the elections will give men an unfair advantage.
Dans le Union, nous avons dit l'OFRDPC.
She says female candidates of her Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, CPDM, have decided to encourage all women who registered to make sure they vote massively on February 9, 2020. She says they are working with all contesting political parties to make sure women take part in the decision-making process. Muma B. Yvonne, national coordinator of the NGO Cameroon Women's Peace Movement, says their campaign is for women to support lists that have a majority of female candidates. She says these are the only ones they are sure can represent the views of women.
We need to be there so that we impact the decisions that affect us like women. If we need a health center or women need to attend antenatal in a certain area, a woman is well placed to understand the plight of women. Women have a different way of looking at governance, but if we are not there to influence policies, how do we get that level playing ground that we all dream for?
The elections were called by Cameroonian President Paul Biya last November. Before then, delegations of women, led by the NGO More Women in Politics, visited towns and villages, encouraging females to run for political office. Political parties agreed with the NGO and increased to 42% the number of female candidates in the race. But traditionally, many women do not vote because they are restricted by their husbands and communities who believe they should carry out only domestic chores or go to the farms. Some women fail to participate due to illiteracy. This year, it is feared the number of female voters will further decrease because of the separatist conflict that has killed at least 3,000 people in Cameroon's northwest and southwest regions. There, armed groups fighting to separate the English-speaking regions from the French-speaking majority country have vowed the elections will not take place. Most voters in the north and southwest have relocated to safer localities where the Election Commission says it has taken special measures to enable them to vote. Within the past 3 days, the SDF and CPDM political parties said the separatists attacked 4 campaign teams in the towns of Mbengui, Batibo and Bafut and abducted at least 20 people, including 13 women, whose whereabouts is still unknown. Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment and the Family, Marie-Thérèse Abena-Ondua, says such acts of intimidation should not discourage women.
It is important for them to go and really decide, choose the best candidate, and take into consideration the list that have valuable women, women who can bring a plus to the development of our country.
Ondua said the government would protect all voters. More than 40% of Cameroon's nearly 9 million voters are female, and women in the Central African state constitute about 52% of the population. But just 6% of Cameroon's 380 mayors, 31% of the 180 lawmakers at the National Assembly, and 21% of the senators are women. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A teen activist who has become the face of the youth movement to fight climate change has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Two lawmakers in Sweden have nominated Swedish teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg for the 2020 Nobel Peace Prize. The lawmakers say Thunberg has worked hard to make politicians open their eyes to the climate crisis, and they say action for reducing our emissions and complying with the Paris Agreement is therefore also an act of making peace. The Young Swede has encouraged students to skip school to join protests demanding faster action on climate change, a movement that spread beyond Sweden to other European nations and around the world. Any national lawmaker can nominate somebody for the Nobel Peace Prize, and three members of the Norwegian Parliament had nominated Thunberg last year. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And you're listening to International Edition. We will be back in a minute.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, today is World Cancer Day, and as it is being observed, health officials are warning of the dangers of betel quid chewing. It's a risky but popular habit in many Asian countries. One of them is Myanmar, where more than half of the men chew it. Dave Grunebaum has more on this tradition and its dangers.
Across Myanmar, it's easy to find roadside stands selling betel quids. The signs of this habit include the red stains on teeth, as well as streets and sidewalks.
After I chew betel quids, my mouth feels better and my mind feels relaxed.
I have bad breath. I want my mouth to smell better.
Figures from the World Health Organization show that almost 25% of women in Myanmar chew betel quids, and more than 60% of the men do. Aung Thura is 30 years old and has been chewing betel quids for 8 years.
It keeps me awake and it keeps me from getting bored when I'm working.
Betel quids are made from areca nuts that are placed in a betel leaf with slaked lime. In Myanmar, it's usually mixed with tobacco. Health advocates say the nicotine in the tobacco and the arecaline in the areca nuts are a bad combination.
And they are addictive chemicals. So by having two things together, people like to chewing more and more.
Dr. Thansen is the head of the People's Health Foundation, a health advocacy group in Myanmar that's trying to educate the public about the risks. Their campaigns have included television spots with betel quid chewers who are terminally ill.
Betel chewing, the first major cause is mouth cancer, oral cancer, then laryngeal cancer, and then lung cancer, and also stomach cancer.
According to the WHO, someone who regularly chews betel quids mixed with tobacco for a long period of time is more than 7 times more likely to get oral cancer than someone who does not chew it. But some people dismiss the risks.
I'm not worried. Nothing happens like that. Chewing betel quid doesn't lead to mouth cancer, only if you leave it in all night.
But Dr. Thansen says the risks are clearly there for all betel quid chewers, especially anyone who chews it for more than a decade. And all too often, they find out they have cancer when it's too late to cure.
Because cancer is caused slowly, and people do not know it. And once they know it, they are almost dying.
But in Myanmar, all signs point to betel quid chewing remaining one of the country's most popular habits. For VOA News, Dave Grunebaum, Yangon, Myanmar.
This is Science in a Minute.
A Northwestern University-led team of scientists recently developed a method that may help determine if an exoplanet can actually support life. The technique checks a planet's habitability by combining 3D climate modeling along with atmospheric chemistry. To determine a planet's habitability, the new tool measures radiation emitted by the star as well as the rotation rate of the planet itself. The researchers found planets orbiting stars emitting a lot of ultraviolet radiation lose much of its liquid water to vaporization, while planets around stars with low levels of UV radiation tend to preserve their supplies of water. It was also found that even planets with livable surface temperatures could be inhabitable if surrounded with thin ozone layers. This would allow the planet to be bombarded with dangerous levels of UV radiation. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And you're listening to International Edition. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great day. I'm Lori London in Washington.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.